On this Labor Day, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. The most recent federal data on unionization shows that about 15 million workers in the U.S. were represented by a union in 2019. And amid the pandemic, unions are speaking up. The American Federation of Teachers authorized strikes if districts couldn't ensure teacher safety. Politico reports the pandemic has made some union leaders hopeful that it will strengthen their cause. Teachers and public workers, what effect has Act 10 had on your job since it took effect in 2011? What is the role of unions in this pandemic? We're at 800-642-1234. John Shelton is a professor of democracy and justice studies at UW-Green Bay, where he teaches and researches the past and present of working people, unions, and jobs. John, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me, Kate, and happy Labor Day to all of your listeners this morning.
Happy Labor Day to you, too. We are approaching that 10-year mark of Governor Walker's landmark law, Act 10, that severely restricted the power of public employee unions to bargain collectively. So what is the state of organized labor in Wisconsin today?
Yeah, so, just remind your listeners that, 10 years ago when Act 10 happened and, you had this law that really restricted the rights of public employees to collectively bargain, at least in any meaningful way. I would just remind your listeners that it did a number of things, but one thing they might not remember is that there was really a political bent to this, right? So, like, one thing I'll just remind your listeners about is that one of the things the law did is it prevented workers from having dues automatically deducted from their paycheck for their union, even if they said that they wanted to, right? So, like, state employees can get donations deducted from nonprofits sometimes. So, the rhetoric was really about, saving money, but there were these other things in the bill that really was about weakening unions. So I think we should be clear about that. So there was an enormous uprising. Workers and their unions didn't take it lying down. But the situation in the past 10 years has been one in which the political aspirations, to a certain extent, of the people, Walker and the Republicans who push for this bill, have been realized. So, a lot of public employee unions have lost membership, in some cases fairly dramatic. But I think for public education, and I'm sure we'll get to this, the outcomes have been pretty significant. So there's been a lot of teacher turnover, particularly as teaching jobs look more attractive in neighboring states. But the thing that I hear a lot from teachers when I'm talking about the impact of Act 10 is actually non-economic. What I hear from a lot of teachers is that what Act 10 did is it basically took these things that they were able to negotiate, professional development, what some of their, non-teaching duties might look like, things that would ultimately sometimes make them more effective. It took those things and made those decisions unilateral on the part of the administrators at their schools. And even if those administrators are well-meaning people, there's really been a situation where it's taken away teacher voice and made a lot of teachers feel very disempowered, made them feel as if they, don't have a say in their workplace, and, to a certain extent has made it more difficult for them to teach. So, there are some pretty significant outcomes from Act 10. But the labor movement is alive and well in Wisconsin. I don't think there's any significant local unions that have just collapsed in the mm-hmm. public sector.
And I think we just lost John Shelton. John Shelton, I'm not sure if you're, are you still there? Nope, we don't have. There we go.
I'm still here.
You're still here. Let me pause for a moment as my heart beats here. Let's reintroduce you. John Shelton is a professor of democracy and justice studies at UW-Green Bay. We're looking at the state of unions on this Labor Day, and we're taking your questions about unions. How has the pandemic changed the way labor looks for you? What could the state do to improve the state of unions or to decrease their power? Join in 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Ed now, joining us from West Bend. Hi, Ed.
Good morning. The biggest thing in 2020 is that organized labor has this bill in the Congress called the PRO Act, the Protecting the Right to Organize Act. It would totally eliminate legislation like Act 10 and right to work states. They would be gone. That bill came out of the House. Ms. Pelosi got that bill out of the House in January of 2019. And for 20 months, it sat and languishes in Senator Lamar Alexander's help committee, not going anywhere because of the diabolical nature of Mitch McConnell and Lamar Alexander. We would not have right-to-work states. We wouldn't be going through what we went through in Wisconsin in March of 2015, where Scott Walker lied.
And, Ed, I want to pause here and allow John Shelton to speak to federal legislation and the impact on right-to-work states. What is federal legislation like?
Yeah, so, you know, thanks, Ed, for the comment and the question. You know, one of the things that it's important to point out, American labor law is really complicated. So, you know, when he was talking about the 2015 right to work law, that actually impacts private sector employees in Wisconsin. So, you know, Act 10, of course, only impacted those employees who are government workers. Now, what's interesting is that, as he mentioned, the PRO Act would, you know, that this version of it would actually, I'm pretty sure, allow for a federal statute that would basically preempt state statutes like Act 10. Now, the problem with that is, and this is really interesting, back in the 1970s, there was an effort to pass a national collective bargaining rights for public employees, right? So Act 10 wouldn't have been possible had this law been passed, and there was a lot of momentum for it in the mid-1970s. There was a Supreme Court decision in 75 or 76, I can't remember the exact year off the top of my head, but it basically invoked the 10th Amendment, which is, you know, the amendment that says anything not enumerated in the Constitution belongs to the states. Now, this was a law that was about minimum wages, so it wasn't about collective bargaining. But what the Supreme Court decision said basically is that state and local governments, you know, have jurisdiction over the labor rights of their public employees. So were the PRO Act to pass, were it to get through the Republican legislature and then signed by Trump, That's a very iffy proposition there, of course, very unlikely to happen. It would be interesting to have the Supreme Court revisit this because it's quite possible that since that's the most relevant statute, that something like that for public employees wouldn't really hold up necessarily in the courts. So we'd have to see. That was 40 years ago, but I'm skeptical that even the PRO Act would do something to preempt Act 10. We probably need something to happen at the state level for teachers and other public employees to get their collective bargaining rights back.
We are looking at labor issues with UW-Green Bay Democracy and Justice Studies Professor John Shelton. What can you say about collective bargaining as we approach the decade mark since the passage of Act 10? How has the pandemic changed the way unions operate? What are you watching for from unions amid calls for hazard pay and more PPE, personal protective equipment? Join into the conversation about unions on this Labor Day. We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. There's more State Cap in just a moment with John Shelton right here on the Ideas Network. On this Labor Day, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're checking in on collective bargaining in America. Labor unions have traditionally been an effective way for workers to voice concerns about workplace safety, but many essential workers are not represented by unions. According to the Economic Policy Institute, just over 1 in 10 essential workers are covered by a union contract. How are you seeing unions respond to the pandemic? What effect has Wisconsin's right to work law had on labor in our state? What union actions are you following now? Join in 800-642-1234. We have UW Green Bay labor researcher John Shelton, who is our guide. So, John, let's fast forward to the pandemic here, where we've seen strikes over hazard pay, over low pay, over unsafe working conditions due to poor social distancing or lack of PPE. Where are unions in this pandemic?
Yeah, so, you know, it's interesting because, you know, unions that have, you know, collectively bargained contracts obviously have, you know, sort of automatically a little bit more leverage with their employers. We talked a little bit about, we were talking a little bit more about teachers and some of their demands. You know, in some places, you mentioned this at the very top of the hour, the AFT has basically said they would support safety strikes of locals.
American Federation of Teachers.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you. And you've seen really some particular locals, especially in Chicago and Los Angeles, you know, they haven't gone on strike, but they've basically been taking the stand that, you know, they're going to leverage this situation to ensure, you know, that schools open safely, to leverage the organizing work that they've done, the power they've built in their unions. And you know, in some cases, they're actually calling for very capacious things, as we're seeing, you know, particularly with the absence of any more federal relief for, you know, the COVID crisis. You know, there's going to be a rise. There already is a rise of evictions and food insecurity, particularly among some of our most vulnerable citizens. So in places like that, those unions are actually saying, you know, we're going to consider actually withholding our labor until the city does something to make sure that our students can be successful. But I want to make a more important point than just that. A lot of those demonstrations that you mentioned a second ago, some of those were led by unionized workers, and some weren't. Some were led by, you know, workers who undertook demonstrations. That I'm thinking about the Amazon protest that happened that really kind of started as a you know, grassroots effort of workers. And the key thing with unions, obviously, you know, collective bargaining helps. But what actually gives unions their power as democratic organizations is organizing, is having workers all take a stand together. You know, so that's why, to circle back to, you know, Act 10 for even just a second, the unions in Wisconsin that are, I think, most successful now are the ones that have continued to organize, continued to have workers, you know, basically joining together and advocating for common interests. And, you know, so I think we're going to see more of that in the next few years as things become more dire because of this pandemic.
I was looking at an online petition this morning that was created by Trader Joe's employees, and it was signed by more than 21,000 people. And the first line of the petition says, "We won in a way." And it goes on to say that while Trader Joe's isn't providing hazard pay to thousands of its workers, the petition itself did raise awareness among coworkers of the power of collective action. Can you speak to the role of these online petitions today?
Yeah, so I mean, I think online petitions are helpful, particularly with companies that are very conscious of their image, right? So Amazon, for example, is one of those companies. A few years ago, you know, your listeners probably remember all of the attention the Fight for 15 got. And, you know, that was really about sort of mobilizing public opinion. Workers at fast food restaurants and other places, there was a campaign called Our Walmart, you know, would do these sort of demonstration strikes. Your listeners may remember the Black Friday strikes that happen every Thanksgiving, sort of every year. And those were very short strikes. They weren't the kind of like open-ended walkouts that a lot of your listeners probably think about when they think about the labor movement. These were short, targeted strikes in order to demonstrate and embarrass corporations that are treating their workers unsafely. And so, you know, I think a petition like the Trader Joe's petition that you're referencing has that sort of possibility, right, to sort of publicly say, hey, you're shopping at Trader Joe's. Look at what's actually going on here. I think it's important for your listeners to remember that those 21,000 people, probably most of them probably not all of them were workers. Some of them, of course, were. But a lot of them were people in the public sphere who supported them. So I think that's the primary, you know, kind of benefit of those kinds of petitions. It's no substitute for the actual organizing of the workers, though, at, you know, who work for Trader Joe's. So, you know, taking action requires that all the, you know, a good portion of the workers at any given worksite are willing to take that action. And the key thing is withholding labor, right? So,
you know, when those workers say we're not going to work for Trader Joe's, it doesn't just embarrass them. There's a direct economic cost because they can't do business. So online petitions, you know, provide some sort of momentum for workers. But, you know, for organized workers to really be successful, they really have to organize.
We're talking with John Shelton, a professor at UW-Green Bay, where he researches the past and present of unions and jobs. John, I want to look at the aftermath of George Floyd's death and police unions, the role of police unions, because there were reports suggesting that the unions bear some of the responsibility for the violence perpetrated against African Americans. And critics say police unions are protecting officers who have abused their authority. Are police unions problematic?
Well, so this is an enormously complicated question. I appreciate you asking me this. We only have a couple minutes left. But, you know, there is a major conversation happening right now in labor circles about this very thing. So, you know, a lot of union activists are saying, you know, police are workers. They deserve to have the right to organize and collectively bargain like anyone else. A lot of union leaders right now are worried that by focusing on police unions, you know, critics are sort of wrongly, you know, blaming unionization when they should be looking at the bigger structures that enable some of the things that you're talking about with George Floyd and Jacob Blake, like the way police are trained, the militarization of the police, and the sort of political fears that mayors and district attorneys have for holding individual officers accountable. And a lot of union leaders are really worried because any attempts to sort of go after public sector unions actually disproportionately impacts African-American workers who are disproportionately represented in the public sector ranks. But there are people in the labor movement now that are basically calling on police to take some initiative in reforming aspects of their collectively bargained contracts that make it difficult to hold police accountable. So, you know, there are union contracts that have been negotiated that, you know, allow departments to erase disciplinary records or prevent departments even from publicizing records of police misconduct. And there are unions now that are actually calling to expel police from federations. This happened in Seattle actually earlier in the summer, where a labor council, the labor council there in the Seattle area, actually voted to expel the police union there.
Would police unions be part of the larger American labor movement? Are they included, or are they different?
Yeah, you're reading my mind, because that's where I was about to get to. There's always been this sort of tenuous relationship between police unions and other unions. So your listeners might remember that the police unions were exempted from Act 10. So were firefighters, but the firefighters union largely demonstrated with other protesters. The police didn't. But the complicated thing is only about a very small portion of police officers are actually even affiliated with organized labor, with the National American Federation of Labor, CIO. So, you know, the International Union of Police Associations is the only union that's affiliated. So, you know, you have some, even at the national level, some unions like the Writers Guild that are calling on the AFL-CIO to disaffiliate. AFL-CIO has not wanted to do that. They basically said, we're going to try to use our leverage to hold the IUPA and their members more accountable. But you've got to remember that the vast majority of unionized police officers are either in independent unions or with other national organizations like the Fraternal Order of Police that are not affiliated with other unions. So, you know, the question is basically like, you know, how do other unions sort of work to, you know, hold police unions accountable and you know, basically prevent the murders of Black people from happening?
Well, now here we are in our last minute, and I want to ask you, how are unions and their endorsements playing out on the presidential campaign trail?
Yeah, so, you know, obviously I think a lot of unions see this as a major moment. The vast majority of, you know, organized labor has backed Joe Biden. I think their argument is that the Trump administration has been pretty disastrous for working people. Your listener actually kind of hit on it. I mean, you know, the Trump administration and Republicans in the federal government have done nothing to support the rights of workers in either public sector or private sector. You know, so most unions are backing Biden. You know, and I think that the plan there is to not just basically, you know, support a political candidate, but say we need workers to organize in this country. We need them to fight to get their collective bargaining rights back. And that's actually going to transcend any presidential endorsements.
Well, John, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. And happy Labor Day again to your listeners.
John Shelton is a professor of democracy and justice studies at UW Green Bay. He wrote the book Teachers Strike, Public Education and the Making of a New American Political Order. Coming up, the State Capitol Report continues with Representative Jim Steinecke, who's chairing a new task force to address racial disparities. What police reforms do you want lawmakers to act on in a special session? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll be back for more State Cap right after this news update with Representative Jim Steinecke right here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the State Capitol Report on this Labor Day. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Governor Evers made a renewed call for lawmakers to meet and take action on police reform bills after an officer shot Jacob Blake in the back 15 days ago and left the black man paralyzed. It sparked a storm of protests for racial justice. Republicans are creating a task force, and Assembly Majority Leader Jim Steinecke was tapped to lead a speaker's task force on racial disparities, educational opportunities, public safety, and police policies and standards. What do you want the task force to take up? What bills on policing do you want the legislature to act on and get up to the governor's desk? What suggestions do you have for legislation that addresses systemic racism and inequality? We're at 800-642-1234. Representative Jim Steinecke is a Republican representing Wisconsin's 5th Assembly District. Representative Steinecke, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, Governor Evers told PBS Wisconsin a few days ago, we don't need a task force. People want action. Why did Republicans decide to form a task force instead of working on the floor on these bills in a special session?
Well, I find it kind of ironic that the governor takes that stance when he himself has created many different task forces to look at issues that are facing Wisconsin today. So for him to dismiss the idea of a task force is interesting to me. But the reason we created this task force is so unlike what the governor and Democrats did in this package of legislation, we really want to bring people together surrounding this issue. We want to bring Democrats along with Republicans and then people of color and communities throughout Wisconsin together with law enforcement to vet the bills that the Democrats laid out there, look at things that the Wisconsin Professional Police Association put out just last week, as well as other ideas from other states as far as what they've done to tackle this issue. So we want to make this a broader-based approach that brings voices together to come up with solutions.
Who's on the task force and when will it meet?
So the task force, we're currently working on the composition of it. We'll be announcing a co-chair, which will be a Democrat. Tomorrow we'll announce that, who that's going to be. And then going forward, that co-chair and I will be making decisions together on who we think should be on the task force. But let's be clear that the task force is going to have less legislators and more people from communities of color throughout the state working with law enforcement to come up with these solutions.
You've said that you've been talking with members of the Legislative Black Caucus. What have they been telling you?
We had brief discussions after last week when I was down in Madison. I think things went well. We talked about what we wanted to see come out of this task force, what they wanted to see come out of this task force, and really came up with what I think is a common vision for what the ultimate goal should be, and that's coming up with real change and gaining off of some of this momentum that has been created over the last several months.
What does real change look like to you? I mean, you've got 9 bills from the governor that first announced in June. Now you've got a slate of 24 bills from the police union. What do you want to see?
Really, what I want to see is, again, bringing people together so we can come up with that common vision, that common goal of addressing this, the racial disparities that exist here in the state. I mean, whether we're talking about police reforms, educational reforms, whatever we're talking about, wherever there is a gap that is created by simply by somebody having a different color of skin, those are things that we want to look at. Obviously, what we'll start with is the policing reforms, but I don't think that that's the only issue that's facing people of color here in the state, and I think we should be taking a broader look.
When you say the broader look, where else do you want to, put forth bills and work?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's going to be addressed over time, but the name of the task force is you rattled off earlier. Really speaks to what we'll be looking at, whether it's disparities in education or workforce development, the lack of investment in communities of color. Those are all things that we need to be looking at.
One of the bills Governor Evers has is the ban on chokeholds. Where do you stand on that?
Well, again, I think that is, in talking to law enforcement, virtually no agency uses chokeholds anymore here in the state. So I think that's an easy one. But, I'm not going to prejudge anything. I want to work with communities of color and law enforcement to make sure that whatever we do, that we can gain some consensus on individual pieces of legislation.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Representative Jim Steinecke, a Republican representing the state's 5th Assembly District, the Kaukauna area. We're looking at police reform, the new task force, and what will be done as part of addressing racial inequities in Wisconsin. You can join in with your insights, your questions, 800-642-1234. Representative, Democratic State Senator Bob Wirch feels that the state should fund body cameras for all county and municipal law enforcement officers. Will this be among the topics discussed by the task force? Will you look at body cameras?
Yeah, I certainly think that we'll look at issues like that. I think that, if you look at the case down in Kenosha, body cameras were in their budget for next year. Obviously doesn't help in this situation. That happened down there this year. But something I think is definitely important to look at. The problem is always coming up with the funding, right? I mean, whether it's allowing locals to exceed their levy limits to purchase body cameras or whether it's the state funding, we have to start looking at some of these solutions because it's just too critical of a need for departments to go without.
I want to get back to the task force for a moment. It seems as if Democrats and Republicans were operating on a couple different timelines here. Democrats would like to see lawmakers working on these bills at the Capitol in a special session. And this task force has a different timeline with different voices in it. How do you make those two different worlds come together here and work across the aisle?
Well, you make Democrats part of the decision making as we go forward with this task force, and I think that's the intent of the creation of this task force is to have it co-chaired by a Republican and a Democrat, and then also bringing again, like I said, people from a diverse set of backgrounds throughout the state together to make these decisions. Because the only way you're going to get buy-in from everybody, the only way we're actually going to get a package passed is if you have law enforcement working with people of color and working with legislators to gain consensus around these issues to move things forward. That's the best way to do things. Unfortunately, it hasn't been the way things have been done over the course of the last year and a half, 2 years or so, but hopefully this will show the way and show a different way of how we can work together to get some of the big issues addressed.
Will there be action taken on the task force's recommendations ahead of November? Will there be work be done in special session?
Yeah, so it won't be before the election. The timeline is we're working right now to put together the task force. That'll happen over the course of the next couple of weeks. We're hoping to have our first meeting by the end of September, first week of October. But we're going to have a pretty aggressive schedule of meeting regularly over the course of the next couple of months here leading into the next legislative session to make sure that we have a package ready to go to hit the floor as soon as we come back in January.
At this point, what is this task force hoping to find that hasn't already been established in previous commissions on race?
Consensus. That's the main thing that we want to find in this, is to make sure that we can all come to the floor voting on a package of bills that has a broad base of support throughout all communities. That's the main goal, but also making sure that we're doing something real that's going to have an impact. The bills that the Democrats put out back in June, a lot of them are fine, and I think a lot of those will be part of the ultimate package that comes out of this task force. But let's be honest, none of them would have made a significant difference when it comes to what happened down in Kenosha, or even what happened along the lines of something that happened in Minneapolis. It just probably wouldn't have made much of a difference when it comes to those two circumstances.
Let's take a call. Chris is joining us from Appleton. Hi, Chris.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
One question. I support the idea of a task force. What I'm not hearing, though, about this task force is, do you acknowledge that there is an excessive use of force by our police under certain circumstances?
So I appreciate the question, Chris. And, that's something that we're going to be looking at. I mean, if we're talking about the issue that happened in Kenosha, I'm not going to prejudge that. I know the governor came out within hours and said that even though we don't have all the details, he launched into, calling it police brutality and excessive use of force. I think we really have to be careful to wait to see what the results of the investigation are, because at first, if you remember, it was being reported that Jacob Blake was unarmed. Now it's been shown that there was a knife at least in his vicinity during this shooting. So we just have to be really careful to wait for the results to come out. But that's one of the things we want to address, too, is that it's said that use of force happens and occurs in about 3% of arrests. Well, use of force is pretty widely defined. Can be something as small, as little as putting your hands on a suspect as you're trying to arrest them. So I think we have to come up with a really set definition of what use of force is and make sure all departments are reporting based on that definition.
We have Representative Jim Steinecke on the line, who's been named chair of the Assembly Speaker Robin Voss's Task Force on Racial Disparities. Are you optimistic that Republicans and Democrats can work across the aisle on police violence and a package of bills? What legislation do you want to move forward to address inequalities and policing in your community? It's 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with more State Cap on the Ideas Network. It's the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation now with Representative Jim Steinecke. He's chairing a new task force. And meanwhile, the largest police union in Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Professional Police Association, has unveiled a set of 24 legislative proposals addressing police reform in the state. It's a sweeping package that it hopes the legislature will consider. Let's take a call now. Scott is joining us from West Bend. Hi, Scott.
How are you?
Doing well. Go ahead.
I guess I have a little bit of a unique perspective. I was in the police explorers as a kid, and as such, I was curious of what the thoughts were about having the use of force being reviewed by an independent organization or group, not where it's going from one police jurisdiction to the next, and then being able to have like a retired officer or something as a consultant to aid the independent group with the reviews of those situations?
Yeah, no, I appreciate that, Scott. And we are not closing the door on any possible solution. I know you're probably aware that any officer involved shooting that results in death, an outside agency does investigate. In those circumstances, I think we could certainly look at broadening that to involve any officer involved shooting, whether it ends in death or not. I think those are some of the things that we can look at. I know there has been discussion, and there are things that occur in other parts of the country where more independent boards look at things like that. I certainly am not going to close the door on any possible solution that we can come together around, because I think the most important thing is making sure that when there are circumstances like this, that the investigations and the ultimate conclusions are made very transparently, because we have to gain the confidence back, not only from not only from law enforcement, but from citizens throughout the state as well in the process.
Scott, thanks. Let's bring in Kristen now, who's joining us from Oshkosh. Hi, Kristen. What's your question?
Hi, I have a question for Mr. Steinecke regarding CIT training and training for multicultural issues, people that are of different color than the white community.
And explain CIT, crisis intervention team training, is that it?
Yes, some police departments and sheriff's departments in Wisconsin have the CIT training. Most do not, and I'm wondering if you would be willing to come together for more money in the police department to address these needs.
Yeah, no, I think that's an important part of the overall solution too, is the CIT training. I know many departments are doing that, but you're right, it is a resource issue. I was talking to some local law enforcement just last week. They had mentioned the idea of possibly adding 40 hours to the training requirement in the academy that would include crisis intervention training. So you're getting that right off the bat before you ever become a police officer. But again, that comes down to resources, and anything that we do, we have to make sure, we don't just pass something and walk away. It's got to be able to be funded and put into place in a reasonable time period.
Would that be lumped into de-escalation technique training, which was one of the 9 bills the governor had put forward?
I think de-escalation is separate from crisis intervention training, but I am far from an expert on this, so I'd have to get you the answer on that.
Let's bring in Ryan now in Waukesha. Hi, Ryan.
Hi there.
Hi. My
concern is that while the task force seems to be a well-intended tactic, it also is a delay tactic that's embedded with the bureaucracy to delay anything. The governor wanted the special session to deal with the urgency of the matter and in full view of the full legislature, and has the research behind it. As we know, in many other parts of the country, this is we don't need to remake the wheel. So I see it as a delay tactic. And
I can certainly understand your concerns on that. However, anything that we did, even if, let's say, we move forward with this package of bills, it would require, legislative hearings and, people being brought in to testify on them. We have to understand where these bills were crafted, who was involved in the crafting of them. So it would take some time, whether we went through the regular committee process or we went through the task force. What we want to do is make a very public show with this task force about how we can bring people together around these solutions. I think the transparency is an incredibly important part of this 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 whole situation with trying to come up with solutions. And that's what I think the task force gives us, the ability as Democrats, as Republicans, as people of color and law enforcement, it gives us all the ability to come together very publicly and discuss these things so that when it does come to the floor of the legislature, we can have hopefully unanimous support for these the package that comes forward.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Representative Jim Steinke, who represents the Kaukauna area. He is the Assembly Majority Leader. Let's bring in Dennis now, joining us from Two Rivers. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. I think you're going to have to definitely come up with a differentiation between use of force and restraining suspects.
Right. I think that is something that I think most people don't understand, and I didn't understand before I really started looking into this, is that when something is classified as a use of force incident, that doesn't, what I had in my mind was some kind of violent struggle, where there was a fight, there was either a weapon used or something along those lines. That's not necessarily what happens in a majority of these quote unquote use of force cases. Like I said earlier, it can be as little as putting your hands on someone to restrain them. So that's why I think we have to come up with a definition that is clear and consistent across the state.
Representative Steinke, I want to spend the last few minutes we have with you on COVID. The Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty recently filed a suit against Governor Evers' public health emergency, which was used to implement the mask mandate in the state. Where do you stand on requiring the public to wear masks to help prevent the spread?
Well, I have been wearing a mask everywhere I go. When I'm in public, in enclosed spaces, I think that's a reasonable step to take. Whatever the results of this this legislation or this lawsuit is, that's going to probably be decided after the 60 days of the mask mandate run out anyway. But I think it is an important thing to have determine of what exactly the governor's powers are under these emergency declarations.
How do you see the legislature functioning in special session or at any point under COVID? Would you be meeting in person more, or will it be virtual?
Yeah, that's one of the things that obviously, like anyone else, we're challenged with. Back in April when we had to meet for the COVID relief bill, we did it partially in person, partially virtually to help with social distancing. I assume if nothing changes between now and the beginning of our legislative session, we'll have to do something similar. But hopefully by that point, we're well into having a vaccine and we can start to get somewhere back to normal.
Representative Steinke, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. Happy Labor Day, everybody.
Representative Jim Steinke is a Republican representing Wisconsin's 5th Assembly District of the Kaukauna area. He is the Assembly Majority Leader. Just ahead, working during the coronavirus can be exhausting. We talk with an occupational health researcher about what's happening to our bodies and minds. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.